internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 435 for Wednesday, the 4th of February, 2015. My name is Len Padilla from the snowy wilds of northern Spain, and with me is Dave Neal.
Hey, Len, how are you?
I'm doing well, Dave. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thank you very much. Thankfully, our snow's gone. We just have frosty mornings and clear blue skies at the minute. So we're deep in the depths of winter. But as we know, and as we'll talk about coming up in the show, we have prototype motorcycles going rather fast in circles.
Yes, we do. Finally.
Out in warmer climes.
It feels like it started.
Yeah, I think spring is on the way, mate. I can smell it in the air. It's on the way. The nights are getting lighter. I'm going to work in sort of semi-daylight on night shift, so that's always a good marker that things are going the right way.
Yeah, I can't wait because maximum temperatures of 0 degrees are killing me.
Yeah, you're not used to that kind of temperature ship over in there. But then we've seen pictures from over there as well, which is a bit of a surprise. Wayne Gardner's posted a couple. Ian Wheeler and the Australia Galicia Mark VDS team, they've been testing in cold conditions, but the one it was Jerez, I think, where Wayne Gardner was, and they couldn't ride because it was covered in snow.
Yeah, that was actually Alcaraz.
Oh, is it Alcaraz?
Which
my apologies.
Is pretty far north, and I'm kind of surprised that anybody thinks that they can test there in February. But
yeah, the BSB boys and one or two others have been down at Cartagena and Almeria,
right.
They've had fine weather.
Oh yeah, it's way down south. It's nice, but this far up north, it'll still be cold. But anyway, they'll get their testing in someday.
Yeah, it'll come. But it's nice to know that everybody's out there and doing their thing.
Like you said, it has started.
It has, and it makes me excited. You can tell we're smiling. We know the bike's coming. Oh, it's that time of year. It's the anticipation, isn't it? The anticipation of testing and knowing the season's not too far away from the back of that. And the guys are out there. We have more to talk about on the show and rather than scrabbling around for the news items that we do. Although we do have some great interviews coming in from Phil Hall as well this week. So we shall add to those as we go. But we have some donators this week.
Yeah, I'll run through the list. We've gotten a few people giving us some money to get Phil Hall over to Phillip Island later this year, which will be fantastic. First one, Rick Taylor. We've got Peter Newell from the Bay Area, and a surprise donation from a track day buddy of mine, Andrew Course. So thank you guys. Thank you one and all for giving us the money that we need to get Phil over there.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, it is really great that the guys do donate. It does help us do what we need to do. It is expensive, and Phil he gave us the idea of how much it would be for him to do the interviews, and they are so worthwhile. So if the guys listening, www.motopodcast.com, left-hand side, about halfway down, you have a yellow donate button or a yellow subscribe button. Either is gratefully received, any small amount. We don't look for anything on the large side. It's just whatever you guys can afford to help us out, to bring you certainly for Phil, to bring you the fantastic interviews that he does. Harry and I will be at the MCN London Motorcycle Show next Friday. So we're actually meeting, and we may do our own first outside broadcast for part of the show. So we're looking forward to that. And again, you know, any small donation or even a small subscription would be gratefully received.
You and Harry getting together next week at the MCN show sounds fun. I really wish I could get there.
It's going to be good. I mean, Harry and I have never met. We've done all these shows together, and we've never actually physically met. So to do a show together, side by side, it is something we're looking forward to doing. And there's one or two guys are going to be down there. Scott Redding is going to be around. Carl Fogarty's opening the show.
And just a couple more things to remind people. They can send us their feedback always to motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all of the hosts. Everyone will read it, and somebody may even answer your email. And also remember that we've got the MCN Fantasy League started up. It's pin number 19132. So for those of you that like motorcycle racing so much that you even want to do it virtually, you can join all of the Motopod fans there.
Or if you enjoy motorcycle racing and you want to do it virtually badly like I do, then please feel free to join the league. 19132 is the MCN Fantasy League pin number.
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody's worse at it than me. I don't even try anymore.
Oh, I lose it. I sort of lose interest sort of two or three races in. I get really excited, and then one thing will go bad, and then it's like, fuck it. I can't be doing with it anymore. But I know Harry's better than me, aren't you, Harry?
I don't know if better is the right word. Perhaps just slightly more attentive.
Welcome along, mate. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad.
Good.
It's good to have you here, Harry, because I was just talking to Dave earlier. I'm waiting for the latest news on leathers and helmets.
Oh, don't worry. It's all coming up. I think during the two tests, we're going to have a Motopod just devoted to leather updates.
Oh, excellent. And I hope you can make like an exhaustive document, because I can't really keep it all in my head.
Okay, yeah. I'll make a shared Google Excel sheet type thing so that everyone can follow along.
Blog it.
Paddock Chatter's Matt Dunn did suggest that I make a blog, and that idea has perhaps been taken quite seriously and is being considered for after university.
I think you should, because I don't know anybody who has such
autistic knowledge.
A keen eye. Now, I was going to go keen eye. I was going to compliment you. I was going to go keen eye on the haute couture of the MotoGP paddock.
It's interesting. Plus, it makes you seem a lot smarter just by looking at photos. So, you know.
Like, I can listen to you with Moto 2 and Moto 3 and the teams and the makeup of those teams. You already sound smart enough. So let's not be building your part up too much, or you'll be leaving the rest of us behind.
Is it effective banter in the nightclubs, or does it not really work there?
No. Unfortunately, girls don't really seem to like when I go up and say, did you know that Andrea Dovizioso has switched back to Alpenstar leathers, which he wore during his brief stint at Repsol Honda? Apparently that's not how you
it cools them right off.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently that's not how you get a date with girls anymore. So I don't know.
Don't ask me. I'm well out of practice on that front.
Yeah, we'll have to try. Maybe they're more Casey Stoner fans, so maybe I can tell them about his retro testing leathers. But
everybody's heard of Valentino Rossi, though. You could talk to him about his the woolly hat helmet that he unveiled at Sepang this week.
Yeah, I think Valentino Rossi is the only rider who could get a post on MotoGP.com just about his testing helmet.
Yeah, but he had fun with all the team wearing the woolly hats as well.
Apparently they didn't last long, though, did they? It was a little bit warm out there for woolly hats. I think I only saw three of them with them on, the guys who actually wanted to do it. But there's another marketing angle for Valentino for next year, woolly hats.
I'm sure they're already being made up at the VR46 factory.
I have no doubt. The little minions and what have you, beavering away, putting the next round of merchandise together for 2015. And 2015 being wholly underway.
It's starting to all kick off.
Yeah, it's nice to know. As Len and I spoke about before you joined us, you know, it's good to know that that there's guys going around in circles really, really quickly. And with the timeline on the social media and MotoGP.com is full of news and views and, you know, interesting facts. And you keep an idea on how people are doing. And we've actually got proper comparisons to make as well. I said to Len earlier on, usually I don't make too many notes before the show, as a lot of listeners will be able to figure out, I guess. But I thought, you know what, it's a new year, it's a new start, let's make plenty of notes about testing and have a look and observations, everything else. And I even went through to the different time comparisons for this year. And I thought, just before I spoke to Len, I had a quick flick through social media because I've been on night, so not been able to keep up with things. And David Emmett's done a whole list already. So I went through it, and it's like, Moto Matters is there. I didn't need to bother. So
notes. A guy named David.
Ah. You have copious notes. Your David is who?
I was just going to say that I have a guy who does my copious notes. His name is David.
Where did you find him?
He, you know, wandering around the track. He wears glasses. He looks smart.
Is it the same bloke who does Moto Matters? He's called David as well.
There you go. He might be able to make a living at this someday.
Hey, maybe so. Yeah, if he could get out to the tests and pass on his knowledge and his observations from there, he may be onto something. MotoMatters.com is the place to be for all your testing needs and the observations from an independent view.
Yeah, so now that we're done giving Moto Matters free sponsorship, shall we get on to some testing news?
Yeah, so what did you guys think of testing in general? Was there anything that surprised you, anything that you thought was really interesting, something that you already expected?
I think that the pace of the Ducatis, especially Andrea Dovizioso, that surprised me a bit. Obviously, they're still on pretty much last year's bike with the GP15 not coming, so I was kind of surprised by how strong Dovizioso was. I was also surprised by Mark Marquez's final lap time. Which we'll get to in a bit. That was very surprising. I was also surprised by Alicia Spargo's pace on the Suzuki.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely spot on with Dovi. He's been one of the revelations of the 3 days, especially as he is on essentially the same bike that he almost started with last year, at least a derivative thereof. So as for like-for-like comparisons, he's about the only one that you can make a true comparison with. And yeah, the pace overall, yeah, obviously they're still running in open spec. They still run the softer tyre at this point. But on the opening day, Dovi was 1.8 seconds faster than the same time last year. Which this one thing I looked at before we came on the air over the last sort of day or so is you can't really compare testing times overall unless you have like for like. You know, if one test is in April somewhere, maybe Qatar, you can compare the year before. So I basically compared day one 2015 to day one 2014. And the overall winner in that respect was Dovi, no question. 1.8 seconds faster and 0.1 second faster than his Q2 time back in October. So certainly progression from the Ducati.
I agree with you guys on all of the... you know, the interesting things, the surprising in a positive way things. I think what struck me most was how the both the satellite and the open Hondas performed. I was expecting more.
Certainly, especially from the open Honda. That's been a disappointment in terms of that's supposed to be last year. Yeah, it's supposed to be a lot closer. Jack Miller was running the factory RCV engine from last year. But if you look at Nicky Hayden's time, it's almost identical to the time that they set last year on the third day. There's 0.01 difference over 12 months. That's got to be a concern.
Yeah, if it were any other factory, I would think, you know, oh, they're having a hard time. Oh, they're, you know, it's not as easy as it looks. But with it being Honda, all it makes me think is that they don't care.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Honda bought seven factory bikes, three of which just for Marquez to try and find, you know, what Marquez wants the most.
He had
three almost completely different frames to test. So yeah, maybe Honda are focusing exclusively on the factory. As you say, I was kind of surprised by Crutchlow and Scott Redding's performances. Crutchlow was saying that you know, that this is the hardest bike he's ever had to ride, and he spent a year on the Ducati last year, so that's pretty incredible.
That surprised me, because you don't really get any particular feedback. Everybody, you look at the Honda RC213V, and you say, you know, it's more like an armchair to ride, and Casey rode it really quickly, Marquez can ride it quickly, you know, anybody can ride the RCV quickly. I don't think you can. I think you have to have a specific style to get the best out of that machine. And you have to be an aggressive style, as Casey was, as Marc Marquez certainly is. And even though Cal is renowned for having an aggressive style, you know, he's not struggling, but he is finding it difficult to adjust to going from the Yamaha to the Ducati to the Honda. It's not as easy to ride as maybe it seems from the casual observer, let's say.
Well, I think that the whole Cal aggressive style thing, I think that, you know, obviously the Yamaha, when Cal was still with Yamaha, the Yamaha was based a lot around Lorenzo, and that's why you had riders like Ben Spies really, really struggling to ride the Yamaha, because at that point Yamaha were developing almost entirely for Lorenzo's style, and so Cal then had to try and ride like Lorenzo. And so then when he's gone to Ducati for the year, he's had to change his style more, and now he's having to change his style yet again. So it's hard to keep jumping, I think.
Yeah, I suppose when it comes to, you know, new riders on new bikes, or bikes that are new to them anyway, we'll have to wait at least till the end of Sepang 2 to start drawing any conclusions.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like with anything, you know, it's only testing, so everything with a grain of salt.
Yeah, it's true. But at least we you know, looking at the feedback that Cal's given, and you look at the quotes through the press releases, I know they're sort of flowered up a little bit, but there's a certain amount of honesty, and certainly in some of his tweets, that he's been putting out, that, you know, it's hard work.
Cal has been on Twitter fire recently. He has really been calling out every journalist who says anything a tiny bit wrong. It's pretty fun to see.
I saw him have a dig at Mark Potter from Bennett's earlier on. He said, please don't tweet me. You now work for the dark side. So bless it. So yeah, he's but sometimes with Cal gets misconstrued on social media because with his liberal use of exclamation marks tends to put emphasis in the wrong place.
Yeah, and I think his quotes in the press releases aren't really any better. I think what they do is they actually pass them through a translator, English to Italian, and then Italian back to English.
They must do, because it is sort of Spanglish, isn't it, as was used previously. Because they used it, as we've spoken about this on the show before, when the guys, the English guys certainly, are dealing with Italian, Spanish crews, the English tends to go a little bit on the pigeon side, doesn't it?
Which is weird hearing that.
But I listened back to the interview I did with Jorge Lorenzo, and I did it. I lapsed straight into it. I couldn't speak to him like I speak to you guys. It was slow, deliberate, and sort of, I can't think of the word, not staccato, but you know what I mean. It was deliberate and short sentences. And I listened back now and I'm like, that sounds so shit. But it is. And then starting to tweet like that and put it out in the press releases, really, that needs a little bit more attention.
Yeah, it's always hard doing press release stuff when there's multiple languages involved and you're trying to produce content for multiple languages. But getting back to testing, I guess we'll go through each manufacturer and their performance. And I don't know, I think we should start with the new boys. So Aprilia came back with their new bike, which was highly revised from the one they had at Valencia. Everyone said that it looked more like a prototype instead of just a super bike with some fancy bits on it. And on the first day, Bautista did okay. But then Bautista struggled a bit more with the new Aprilia. On the final day, Bautista was 21st, with Marco Melandri 28th, and Alex De Angelis 27th. But that was on last year's Open ART Aprilia.
And Melandri only put in his fastest lap in on the very last lap, 61 of 61. But still some mileage put in, and a good effort to go to put your best lap in, but it was 4.7 seconds off the fastest time. Is a yawning chasm at this point.
I just wonder what state Melandri's head must be in.
Yeah, that's been brought up a fair bit.
You can just imagine you're going to a test expecting, obviously on this bike, he's not expecting to be up front, but I'm sure he's been given, some assurance by the factory for whom he just did, a very good year in World Superbike. And to come over here and have it just be, a slap in the face, he must really be wondering, what have I done? It must remind him of another bad step he made in the past.
Yeah, I mean, you would anticipate that they would be sort of late top, sort of late teens, into the top 20 at the very least. Coming from where they are, they've got a wealth of experience, but what they don't have this time around is Gigi Delinea.
That's true. That is true. Yeah.
Yeah, it's also interesting that Aprilia seem to keep reminding everyone that next year they'll have a completely new bike to go racing with. So it's kind of like, where do their attentions really lie? Are they really that focused on this year, or are they mostly using this year just to collect data for next year?
I would suggest that they're putting that front up early doors so people don't expect too much. And with next year being year zero, everybody will have a new bike, just about.
Everybody will have a new bike, but I bet there will still be a pecking order.
Oh, no question. It's the same with any kind of racing. The fastest will always be the fastest. And the pecking order doesn't change too much.
Yeah. Speaking of year zero, I was reading, I think it was in MCN, but maybe not. Colin Edwards talking about the new Michelin tires and the difference between them and the Bridgestones. And he said that with the new Michelin tires, you can't carry the brakes in as far onto the corner. You have to start easing the brakes off a lot sooner. So that could potentially have some consequences for riders like Marquez, who are quite get it into the corner, stop it, and then turn it quickly.
That's detrimental to the Honda, isn't it, general, because they can run deeper into the corners.
Yeah, whereas it may help the Yamahas a little, as they're a bit more used to carrying corner speed. But we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think, I wonder if the guys who won't benefit the most from that, because it sounds like, in terms of the stiffness of the construction of the front tire, Bridgestone is a bit of an outlier. All of the other manufacturers are somewhat alike in that sense. I wonder if the guys that still remember what it was like to ride their Moto 2 bikes, which were on Dunlops, which are going to be a lot more similar to the Michelins, I wonder if they're going to have any sort of advantage going into next year. You know, again, being able to draw on that recollection of what's a slightly squishier front tire, and the same goes to the guys that are coming from the Pirelli.
That's an interesting option, because of the guys that are looking to be towards the front over the next year or two, they are Moto2 graduates, with the likes of Paul Espargaro, Marc Marquez, Scott Redding, Maverick Vinales. So they've all got experience of that Moto2, as you described. So, yeah, that could be an interesting angle to look into nearer the time.
Yeah, and a few World Superbike wild cards as well, whether it's, you know, Loris Baz, Eugene Laverty, you know, again, guys that have come from running a pretty soft construction front tire.
Yeah, well, that Leon Haslam really struggles to get on with. He's as rapid as you like on Bridgestones, but the Pirellis, a lot of guys don't get the feel back from them that they do from Bridgestones or Michelins.
We will see.
Indeed. It's all subplots and sub-stories, isn't it? And this is the intrigue part of the season as it all begins. And especially coming into year zero for 2016, we can start looking at the different ideals and scenarios in that respect of the effects that they're going to have on the riders. So it's not just the electronics, it's the tires as well. It's going to be a huge change. But as we're in Sepang 2015. As expected on day one, Marc Marquez was fastest out of the box, but only 0.02 of a second faster than his time of last year. This is what we say of comparing day one of last year to day one of this year. The biggest surprise was the Yamahas, I think, from that respect, being half a second closer to the fastest Honda. They seem to have their house in order early doors this year.
Yeah, it seems like the Yamahas have taken maybe a bigger step just based on testing times. But then again, you also have to remember that Yamaha didn't have as many... Honda was certainly trying to test different things. As I said earlier, Marquez had three different bikes to choose from. Whereas for Yamaha, I think both Jorge and Rossi only had two bikes. And I think that it was in one of the interviews Rossi did where he said that, you know, anytime Yamaha make a part, you know it's going to be better, but they don't make a lot of different parts. So as I said before, it's testing, so grain of salt and all that sort of stuff. But the Yamahas definitely seem quite drastically improved, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. It's, looking through, I mean, I don't know, you're sort of pissing on my parade with all my times and my notes that I've made now and taking everything with a pinch of salt.
Sorry.
I'm just trying to make them put a show together, that was all. It's okay. It's fine.
No, but here, give us some times about how much Yamaha have improved.
Well, Yamaha have improved by half a second over 2014. Cal Crutchlow was 1.1 seconds faster on his first day on the Honda than he was on the Ducati. Interestingly, Paul Espargaro was 0.7 faster and Bradley Smith 0.1. As we said, Dovi was 1.8 quicker. So, you know, everybody's improving, but just by different margins. Interesting that Paul has gone quicker than Bradley slightly. And again, you know, as Jim always tells us, it's only testing, and as you're raining on my parade, it is only testing. But really, there are differences to be gleaned. You know, it is we have to make these comparisons just to see how they go, and then obviously we can compare Sepang 1 to Sepang 2 in a couple of 3 weeks. But over the days, as you say, one of the bigger surprises, well, is it really a surprise as we look into it, but one of the better performances over the 3 days, Maverick Vinales,
yeah,
2.2 second improvement and into the 2 minutes flats. Yes, they have the extra soft rubber on, so that's gonna. But you still got to get on and ride it. And anything sub 2:01 around Sepang, you know, that's not shabby.
Yeah, Vinales's effort was incredible. He was half a second behind his teammate on the third day, and you know, Elish has like 3 or 4 years at least more experience in MotoGP around Sepang. He knows all the braking markers, all that sort of thing. Whereas Vinales is having to, you know, learn a MotoGP bike, learn MotoGP electronics, learn all the braking markers for Sepang and stuff, learn new tires. So yeah, Vinales has definitely been a bit of a, maybe not a surprise, but I think that his jump up the timing was a bit quiet, maybe. You know, on the first day, Vinales was what? Vinales was 21st on the first day. Then on the second day, he was 15th. And then on the final day, he was 12th. So, you know, steady progress throughout. As you say, a huge drop in times. And yeah, just really impressive. Definitely the fastest of all the rookies. How much better that Suzuki is than the customer Honda, it's hard to say. But yeah, definitely making waves, Vinales.
Yeah, Loris Baz as well. Tip of the hat to him. 2.5 seconds faster over the 3 days.
Yeah, big steps for all of them. One thing with Suzuki was that luckily none of their engines blew up this time, so they've definitely improved reliability. However, they are still struggling with rear grip and horsepower, which is something that Depugnet had been commenting on for the last year and a half. So,
and two things required to go faster.
Yes, but both Espargaró and Vinales have been praising to the heavens and back the Suzuki's handling. Apparently it's a very, very nimble bike, so maybe we'll see at some of the tighter and twistier tracks, we'll see the Suzuki do really well. I think the Suzuki, you know, two bikes in the top 12, I think that's pretty decent for Suzuki at the first test. I think they'll hopefully do more engine upgrades throughout the season. From what I can read, it seems like the engine they have now will be the engine they start the season with. I don't know, could be a bit disappointing for Espargaró and Vinales, but I think that there's hope for Suzuki and that maybe it won't be as bad as some people thought it would be.
Yeah, I think they're actually starting off a lot better than anyone expected them to be. I mean, to have them in 10th and 12th at the end of the first test, especially considering what we saw at Valencia with the bikes being, you know, so slow and or blowing up, I think they're starting off a lot better than anyone expected.
Agreed. They've certainly worked hard over the off-season. The reliability side is a huge plus point, because without the reliability, anything else you need to test sort of falls by the wayside. So reliability has to be the number one factor, and they seem to have cleared that, so they can work on the settings, the base settings, and getting the guys up to speed. But yeah, fantastic showing from Suzuki in their first official test of 2015. It's good.
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to win a championship, but no one was expecting them to.
No, and that's the thing, that they don't have the pressure of competing with the other factory teams in their first year back. You know, that they can find their own way. They've got the dispensation, the same as Ducati, so they can explore their own options as they go through. But if they can sort of break into the top 10 over a race weekend, I think that would be the number one target, I think.
Certainly for them. In other news, Héctor Barbera was kind of decently impressive on the open Ducati, especially compared to teammate Demeglio. Barbera was 15th on the final day, with Demeglio in 22nd. They're obviously running the last year's Ducati, but with full open software, not the weird semi-open software that the factory team runs. So Barbera has made a spot in my fantasy road race team, because I feel that hopefully he'll be able to score points consistently every weekend. But yeah, Barbera was another one who seemed really happy and really motivated by the new bike. You know, there were lots of quotes of him saying that, you know, this is the best he's ever felt, this is the best bike he's ever ridden. Much like Lorenzo, who was fifth on the final day, there was a lot of noise made about Lorenzo being much thinner and much fitter than he was last year, and perhaps even ever.
Yeah, he's been working hard through the off-season. If you look on his Instagram and his Twitter, he's always posting pictures of being down at the gym. And like you say, there's a lot been made of how he's approached and how he's turned up for the 2015 season. So I think, it could actually be, and I say this with the hand firmly on heart, this could be the best season ever.
Oh, we're already making these claims.
Best season ever, or year of the goat?
Could you imagine the implosion of the dyed-in-the-wool yellow fans if Valentino does take his 10th title?
There was certainly a lot of noise made on the first day when Rossi was second, and on the third day when Rossi was fourth, about Rossi's ability. Rossi also suffered with some chatter problems towards the end of the week as they experimented with different engine braking stuff. So hopefully they can work out those kinks. But yeah, Rossi's resurgence seems to be more than just a last year thing. It seems like he'll at least be competing with Lorenzo for top Yamaha. Whether he can catch Marquez, we'll have to wait and see. I think that the Honda still has the edge over the Yamaha, but that's just a personal opinion.
And a 158.867 from day three is just incredible.
Yes.
The fastest ever two-wheeled lap of Sepang.
Yes. Usually, you know, if you put in a two-minute dead lap, that's pretty good. If you put in a 159, then you're really getting on. You know, you're clearly a factory rider with that. But a 158, that's incredible.
That's just flicking the V's at everybody else, isn't it? It's like, I'm happy, I'm fast, thank you very much. Banzai lap, and away you go. And he came away with it nicely. Interesting that that Pedrosa's fastest lap, the 159.006, by all accounts on that lap, he had a relatively large wobble as well. So he could have been a little bit quicker. He was quite surprised to put in a time such as that. After the incident out on track. So there's a potential coming in from Danny Pedrosa as well at the end of day three.
You know, speaking of the lap times, the fast lap times, I don't imagine that Stoner was going as fast as these guys since he was, you know, on a different test plan. But does anybody know what his times were like?
No, I've searched far and wide, but unfortunately cannot find his test times.
Disappointed. I was hoping, and maybe we should have dropped him a tweet, but the gentleman that kindly put our spreadsheet together for all the guests on the show, I'm going to get the pronunciation wrong, I know I am, but Ika Karjalainen is out there watching the testing. And I just want, he watched Casey go around, and he's out there watching the MotoGP official test as well. And I did wonder if he might have put a stopwatch on Casey just to see what he would do, but... just at least a ballpark figure, but no, there's nothing on the net anywhere to say what he was actually doing, which is, as you say, it's a little bit disappointing just as a small comparison to see what pace he's running. I would personally suggest he's running about the 2 minute mark. He's still going to be fast enough for that.
Yeah, interesting. I would bet that anybody there had their phone out and was doing a time. It's amazing self-restraint that nobody's tweeting it.
Yeah, maybe we're just following the wrong Twitter accounts. Another interesting thing about the Stoner pre-Sepang test, Sepang Zero, as some people called it, was that he was also testing the 8-hour Honda bike, which led particularly Italian media to suggest that he was being courted by Nakamoto-san to do the 8-hour this year, which would be pretty cool.
That's a race that he could do, isn't it? He doesn't have to come back to GP racing. It's a little more relaxed. The racing itself is intense, but it's not a GP paddock.
And it's a one-off as well, so...
Exactly right. One question I was going to ask, how did they manage to test when there's a testing ban? Was the testing ban up to the end of January and they tested early February?
I think that's what it was, yeah.
But isn't the testing ban for, you know, factory riders on factory bikes at tracks that they race at? Can't they do, you know, other testing at other places?
This is what I mean. I'm not sure if it's an overall umbrella of testing or what. It's just one of those where you just think, well, hang on, there's a testing ban that finishes on the 31st of January, yet they're out there testing the bikes. Yeah, that's the thing. Is it a blanket test ban? Is it a test ban for the factory riders on their bikes, or can anybody ride them at any point?
Between you and me, Dave, if a certain someone wasn't so interested in helmets and leathers, they could probably find that out.
Oh, I think there's no question about that.
I'll look it up for the next show.
thanks, Harry.
Some of us have university as well, you know?
Or hanging around in nightclubs taking pictures of people.
Well, you make it... I'm there in an official capacity. I have a lanyard and everything.
I didn't say you weren't. I just said that's what you were doing.
Okay.
Well, hey, I've even... we introduced the listeners to what we're doing next week, Harry.
Oh, yes. Dave and I will be at the MCN London Motorcycle Show.
Which is really confusing because it's at the same time as the London Bike Show. At the same place.
Wait, what?
Of the cycle variety at XL in London. The MCN London Motorcycle Show is at the same venue at the same time as the London Bike Show.
Well, okay.
I hope we've got press accreditation for the right event.
Yeah.
You guys are going to the wrong show, aren't you?
probably. And it's all Dave's fault. So hopefully we're at the right show. And hopefully we'll have a fan meetup. And we'll tweet that on the @moto_pod account of when and where we're going to meet. We'll also be recording a show there. And we'll also have, hopefully, the stickers arrive in time. If you want a sticker, come up and say hello.
So yeah, interesting. Next week we get to meet up for the first time, and potentially do a live show and bring some of your fantastic photos from the show. There's a whole selection of Valentino Rossi's motorcycles there, Carl Fogarty's bike. So plenty of plenty of subjects for your lens if you're bringing your camera equipment with you.
Yeah, I'll have a very heavy backpack. Let's put it that way. But back to testing quickly to touch on my personal favorite, Jack Miller. You know, obviously a lot's been made of Miller's move up to MotoGP from Moto3. And Miller did okay-ish, I guess. He was 20th on the third day with a 201.895, which was 3 seconds off Marquez's best time. Towards the end of the test, Miller did complain about some fitness issues, some slight arm pump. But what I did find interesting was that just looking at photos and videos, Miller's style seems to be a bit more of an older MotoGP riding style. He's very central on the bike, not so much hanging off the bike like you get Marquez and now Valentino Rossi doing. So, yeah, that was an interesting thing to see, just how his style's still maybe learning.
He did 166 laps over 3 days.
Yeah, that would probably cause...
That's going to test anybody's fitness.
But I guess that it was important for him to do that, because obviously, you know, guys like Lorenzo and Rossi have huge experience with full races on this, whereas Miller doesn't, so maybe it was important for Miller to push himself just that little bit extra to test his fitness. Because
certainly, it's the time to do it.
Yeah, because MotoGP bike, a bit heavier than a Moto3 bike.
And a little bit more powerful.
Just a touch.
Just as you look through the day one times, talking of fitness and bike fitness, Takumi Takahashi, the HRC test rider, did 77 laps on the opening day, and he put his fastest lap in on the 77th lap.
Yeah, there were some people...
There's dedication for you.
Yeah, people were definitely trying super hard, some people. I think it was on the final day, everyone had stopped for lunch, but Marquez was still out there during the lunch break, going hard at it. So certainly Marquez is not sitting down. He's, you know, really working for his title defense.
But when you look at what Valentino is bringing to the table, Jorge Lorenzo is turning up hungry. He's going to have a fight on his hands this year, and he knows it. I really don't envisage him winning all 10 opening races this year. Hey, I've been wrong before. Don't get me, you know, I'll stand corrected nearer the time, but I really don't see that happening this season. Do you?
I'd bet on the same. I mean, I think both of the Yamaha riders are starting this year, or a little, it looks to be anyway, a little better than they started last year.
Yes, and without the fully seamless gearbox, which doesn't come for another 3 weeks.
Mm. Yeah, Yamaha still don't have seamless downshifts, which has been maybe not an area of issue, but certainly something that they could improve.
But what we will have from Sepang 2, Neil Hodgson's heading out to Sepang 2. So we will be chatting to Neil on his return from that test to see what he can glean and any little inside information that he may have.
Super. Always good to have boots on the ground, as they say.
Indeed it is.
In some other MotoGP news that's maybe not testing related, but it's still MotoGP related, NGM are no longer part of Ford Racing. So they have a new title sponsor lined up. And in other title sponsor news, Cardian is no longer sponsoring Carol Abraham, and he will be announcing a new sponsor in, I think it was March. But his dad still gives a lot of money, so...
I was just going to say, does Carol Abraham's dad have some other company that he can sponsor him with?
Maybe.
I'm sure he has friends of friends, and there'll be somebody waiting in the wings to take over that little mantle, I'm sure.
Yep. We can all dream of having a dad that rich, but very few of us get to achieve it.
Or having the talent to be able to ride a bike at that pace.
Yeah. To be fair to Carol Abraham, you know, he's gotten multiple Moto2 podiums and won a Moto2 race, and I think he gets a fair bit of stick unfairly.
I would agree. You've still got to get on and ride it. They're still faster than the average racer, and this is the thing that sometimes when people get a little bit vocal, and why I try not to, and I don't, in most terms, get vocal about riders. They're all quicker than me. Nobody comes to my workplace and tells me they're better than me or I'm crap at what I do. So, you know what I mean in that respect? So, you know, all these guys are faster than me. So a little bit of respect is due. Unless you look at, you know, at Len's profile picture and you see him doing his thing, you know, that's looking super stylish.
Yeah, it looks good. It's, just don't get a stopwatch on that.
You can use a sundial on my times, mate. It's fine.
Yeah, I'll have to pull out my excuse book like these guys do. You know, no, I'm not going for times. You know, we're just out there to learn.
New crew chief.
Exactly. Things like that.
Speaking of new crew chiefs, Scott Redden has been public in his thoughts of the 3 days at the Sepang test. A big learning curve for all, for Chris Pike as the crew chief down there at the Australia Galicia Mark VDS team. The emphasis was on learning over these 3 days. It's a huge change from the production RCV And it's taken its time to get that over. But as David Emmett commented, there's a very, very mature Scott Redding arrived this year, and a guy that's really focused and willing to learn. So we may not see massively incremental steps from Scott over the next couple of tests, but step by step, he will get faster and he will get closer to that top 10.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's maybe another thing that maybe not that the riders realized, but that a lot of the public maybe realized, was that kind of like with the whole Suda Kalex thing in Moto 2, is that, you know, just because you have an air quotes factory/satellite Honda doesn't mean that you're going to be immediately quick. You know,
as we said about Cal earlier on, same thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think that I don't know. It's hard to say what the riders were surprised by, but I think that maybe that was something that the public were surprised by, that both Cal and Redding were, you know, I think it's fair to say they were struggling to get into the top 10, but obviously it's testing, and I'm sure that if Cal listens to this, there'll be a litany of angry tweets waiting for me.
Not at all. It's observation. It's fine. You know, the guys are on the ground. But then again, you don't wear, I think, was it pink shorts with blue Crocs? If you want to look at the haute couture of the paddock with the Cal Crutchlow, you're the man of the fashion variety. So,
you know, when I first saw that, I thought that somehow Harry had gotten himself over to Sepang.
I wish. The pink shorts I'm on board with, it's just the Crocs. I'm not a Crocs man.
No, me neither. I've never worn a pair in my life. So anybody out there? No problem. I have no issue. I'm not Crocist, but I've just never...
Some of your best friends wear Crocs, right?
Oh, God.
That's a great line. I love that. I think that's a decent segue to wrap up testing.
Just one more quick thing on testing, not related to this testing, but there was meant to be a Moto 3. I think it was specifically a Mahindra test at Alcaraz. I think that's how you say it. I don't know. Len will probably correct me.
That's pretty good.
Okay. So they were meant to have a two-day test there. There were also some Moto 2 guys there. I think it was Florian Alt was meant to go there, but the test was snowed out. It's not often that you get to say a test was snowed out, but yeah, the entire circuit was covered in snow and ice for 2 days. You can check out Remy and Wayne Gardner's Twitter feeds for some photos of that. That was pretty incredible to see testing be unable to go ahead because of snow.
The time will come. It'll disappear soon enough.
Yeah, I think that now there's an official ERTA test coming up at, I think it's Valencia, for Moto 2 and Moto 3. So that's when all those boys and girls will next get out there.
Is that this weekend? The first test, I think, is this weekend. Obviously, Ian Wheeler's feed. They're heading off to the first official test with Tito Rabat and Alex Marquez. So there'll be more news next week on that, I am sure. We have some interviews this week, another raft of interviews from the great Phil Hall down at Phillip Island from the PI Classic. Harry, are these remaining the same? Connor Cummins?
Yes.
Peggy Hyde, John Munns, Scout Fletcher, Wade Boyd and Christine Bluck.
These interviews are really unique, especially the Peggy and Scout interviews. I think that they're maybe some of the most unique interviews we've had on MotoPod, and especially those two interviews I personally really enjoyed. Hopefully everyone else enjoys them as much. And remember that hopefully we will be able to get Phil Hall to Phillip Island, but if you go on the motopodcast.com website and hit the donate button on the left-hand side of the page, you can help guarantee that we get to get some more excellent interviews from Phil Hall at the World Superbike round at Phillip Island. So enjoy, everyone.
All right, we found a quiet spot down in the media room, or next door to the media room, where we can get away from the noise of the two strokes a little bit and talk to Connor Cummins. Connor, welcome to Australia for your first visit. Welcome to Phillip Island, and congratulations on being part of Team UK.
Yeah, it's thanks for having me. I've never been out here to Phillip Island before, and I've been made extremely welcome. It's a fantastic place, and I came here in 2009. We did a race at Barbagallo Raceway, I think it's called, and I loved Australia, and I was a bit teary-eyed when I was going home, so I thought I'd get back, and thankfully the Team Winfield opportunity came up, and I grabbed it with both hands, so I'm really pleased to be here.
So Connor, I think it's probably fair to say that there was a time there where you mightn't have been here at all. I guess everybody who knows a bit about road racing and about motorcycling remembers that fearsome accident that you had when you went over the edge of the road and bounced and bounced and bounced and bounced and bounced. We all held our breath. God knows what it was like for you, but that was pretty scary.
Yeah, it was crap at the time. But, yeah, you know, it's it was a horrendous crash. You know, but it's just one of them things. It's just racing motorbikes is dangerous. And sometimes it can get, that danger level can go higher depending on where you're racing at. And, you know, the TT course is a very demanding place in the first place. And, you know, if you crash, you're very, very lucky to be able to talk about it afterwards, put it that way. You know, so it's a very... You know, it can be tricky at times. So I was very lucky to be able to get another lap, shall we say. You know, it took an incredible amount of bloody guts and determination to get back on a bike and racing competitively. You know, you know, I had a broken back. You know, I had to have an operation, a 13-hour operation to stabilise me back with two rods. Had to put my knee back together, my humerus bone and my arm. You know, it was rubbish. But at the end of the day, it happened. You know, I'm over it now. I'm back. You know, it was a lot of hard work. I'm starting to sort of feel really, really good now. You know, I've had some good results last year with Honda Racing and you know, RAF Reserves Honda and Jackson Racing and. You know, I've kept on with two of them teams for this year, with Honda Racing and Jackson Racing for the roads, and we're also doing the World Endurance Championship with Jackson Racing under Honda Fireblade. So it started to come full circle. It's all gone good, you know, it's going good, and I'm looking forward to hopefully a really good 2015.
Connor, you're a road race specialist in terms of proper road racing, you know, Cookstown and, you know, Dunrod and all those Northwest 200 and all those ones that we see on television and close our eyes every time you come to a corner. What are the differences between doing that and, say, racing on a pure racing circuit here like Phillip Island?
The difference is the furniture around the course. You know, circuit's a circuit. You know, you've got Phillip Island here, which is I can't believe I'm actually riding the place, to be honest. This has only happened before. I've only been around on a computer game. So, I mean, it's an awesome circuit, but whereas the TT course, Northwest 200 course, the Ulster Grand Prix course, it's all, you know, public roads, public highways. You know, we're going across junctions where there's usually tractors and bloody cars pouring out, you know. It's a public road that gets made into a road race course, you know, and that's me all over. I love that sort of a circuit, and you know, the most challenging of them all is the TT course, and I love it.
David Taylor said to me a couple of years ago, he said there's a couple of circuits in Ireland, he said you've got hedges on both sides of the road, and he said if you could take your hands off the handlebars and put your hands out, you could just about touch the hedges on both sides.
Yeah. Bit of an exaggeration, like, but he's not far off, but, you know, it's just country lanes, Southern Ireland, Northern Ireland, all the road races they have over there, you know, barring the Northwest 200 and the Ulster, they're all country roads. And I've done a full season and I loved it. You know, they were certainly character building and I really enjoyed them. It was it was a great part of my life, and you know, who knows, I might end up going back to them as well. You never say never, but the Ulster Grand Prix is a fantastic circuit. Again, it's all balls out, as I say. You know, some real gnarly, fast, you know, overcrest corners. You know, you've got to be really committed, and, you know, the Northwest is the same, you know, high speed, you can knock over 200 miles an hour out of the bike, you know, and you're in slipstream and nearly four abreast going down the main carriageway. The TT's a bit different, where you're on your own, and you have to make your own race. You know, it's I just love it. You know, as I say, it's me all over. I love the roads, but I get thrown the occasional treat, like coming out to Phil Bound.
In terms of bike preparation, what's different about preparing a bike for that sort of a circumstance compared to a normal circuit?
The bikes take more of a hammering on a public road, you know. The bike has to be a lot stronger, you know, well built, solid bike. You know, in a short circuit, I'm not saying you don't have to have a really good prepared bike, because you do. But, you know, you can get away with using titanium bolts left, right and centre, all the rest of it, if you want lightweight bodywork. You know, a bodywork's one thing, you know, on the roads you're using thicker bodywork to sort of cope with all the stones that you're sort of getting flung off that line on the road from other bikes. You know, there's a bit of a difference.
So you need speed, but you need durability as well.
Yeah, you need a good bike, you know, because obviously Lady Luck plays a massive role in the whole thing. And you've got to take every box. You've got to have you have to be well prepared. You have to be fit, mentally fit. And, you know, the bike has to be, you know, prepared to the nth degree. And I like that side of it too.
Well, as an outsider looking at it from here and watching the TT and things on television, we sometimes sort of look at it and think, you know, well, some guy retires at the end of lap two with mechanical troubles, and you think to yourself, well, you don't see that in circuit racing. I mean, most Japanese bikes are so bulletproof you can just about do anything to them and they'll keep going. Mm-hmm. And you think to yourself, why at the TT, why do these bikes break down? But I mean, I think you've already answered the question why they break down, because they just get punished.
Yeah, I mean, you're not talking, as I say, you're talking about public roads. You know, and in the UK we've got some rough roads. You know, the Isle of Man is obviously, the government does a great job in trying to keep them as best they can.
Sure.
But when you're talking the public road turned motorcycle racing circuit, and you know, you're going down country A roads, which are lined with trees. You know, you can get trees that are growing roots under the circuit and pushing a bump up every now and again. You know, that's what creates some of the problem, is the amount of bumps that there are on the circuit, A for handling on your bike, and what it does in turn to damage-wise to your bike, you know. It really puts it through at paces,
yeah.
You know, and you really need a good prepared bike.
And we see the riders pull in for their mandatory pit stops at the Isle of Man, for example, and they clean all the bugs off them and so forth. That's an issue that you don't get on a normal circuit either, isn't it?
No, well, today we had a few problems with flies and whatever, but, you know, on the visor, but, like, for TT, yeah, two laps, straight in for your pit stop. You've got to come down to 60k, you can't do any more than that, otherwise you get a penalty. Mm-hmm. You have to watch...
Which has been the cause of a bit of controversy
It's been controversy there, you know, it's... it's caused some bloody problems over the years, but... It's got to be done, you know. It's a safety thing, I think, you know, and adds another. On the flip side of that, it adds another cool element to the TT race itself, because it's another. You've got to be thinking, you know. And then you've got to watch. You know, you come into your pit box. Is your man still in front of you? You've got to drive into his legs. The wheel man is under your bike with his already for the bike with the stand up on the stand, rear wheel out, new fresh. Dunlop rear slicking, and you know, fuel going in the tank as well, visor change, drink and all the rest of it. There's so many bits and pieces that just people don't appreciate, you know. It takes a lot of brain power to do all that. And then you got to go back out on track and do another two laps and do it all over again.
And this is a subtlety that's lost on if you are watching it from the outside, because at the TT, you're not racing against other riders, you're racing against the clock. So every fraction of a second that you save by being efficient...
What race is that?
By being efficient and clever
in
the pits is time that you don't have to risk yourself trying to make up on the track.
Oh, of course. Yeah, you know. It's, as I say, it's all that you prep yourself as best you can to put on the most cleanest race you've ever done. you know, and the pit stops have to be slick. But at the same time, it's very, very easy to get carried away and, you know, keep calm, you know, because it's a highly pressurised environment. And everything has to run smooth, but, you know, there's been occasions where things haven't gone smooth and I've been on the receiving end of it. You know, it's it makes it interesting.
So when you say change visor, you don't use tear-offs anymore, you just take the visor and put a brand new one on?
We do use tear-offs.
As well?
As well. We use I use two tear-offs. Use them as and when I need them on the circuit. You know, when we do actually get a break. And then it's in, you know, we change another visor, we get a fresh visor for an AGV helmet. Yeah.
So they just clip straight out, clip another one in, they've got one ready for you to go.
Yeah, I mean, they're slightly modified in order for a quick release. And that's, you know, my guys are really good, the AGV guys, they do the TT pit stop for me. My mate Stu, he's a good guy, he's ultra slick and... you know, he's fine-tuning it, but again, boils down to the preparation. You know?
Connor, last year I asked Mike Edwards what it was like to ride a Harris Suzuki around Phillip Island, and he came up with the quote of the weekend. He said it was a bit like dancing with a fat lady in a phone booth.
Yeah, that's a new one for me. Bloody hell. No, it's they're very, very different. You know, the my Harris Honda is a good bit of kit. You know, it handles real good. You know, you're talking a classic bike. You know, times have changed. My riding style has been developed on modern machinery. So to go back to a classic bike has made it very, very interesting, and I'll certainly go back to my modern bike and appreciate it a lot more. You know, I'm having just loads of fun on the Team Winfield classic bikes, you know, great bikes, really enjoying it.
He runs a great show, doesn't he?
Yeah, you know, we've had a bit of a testing couple of days here, really. We've had some problems, but, you know, Roger and all his guys, Roger and Pat, and they're really pulling out all the stops to get those boys going, and it's, you know, I really appreciate it.
I'll leave that here, Connor, because you probably need to be getting back soon, and I don't want to be holding you up from the stuff that you have to do just for something that you want to do. Thank you so much for your time.
No problem.
Appreciate the fact that you're able to bring us the perspective that us laymen aren't able to have, because we wouldn't have the guts to do what you do, or the skill level or anything else. So I really appreciate that you can sort of let us peek behind the scenes, you know?
I'm a layman just trying to ride a bike.
Well, you have my admiration and the admiration of everybody else, believe me. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I hope you have the rest of your weekends is as good as what it's been so far. And
Thank you very much.
And you come back in 2016.
Well, if they'll have me, I'll be back. That's you know, for sure. You know.
Judging by the impression you've made so far, I don't think there's too much doubt about that. Thanks, Connor Cummins.
Appreciate your
time. Thank you very much. All right, back in the Team USA pit with John Munns from Team USA, and John, you're holding up the small end of the Team USA effort with your little Honda. How's it been going so far?
It's been going pretty well. The bike's running fairly well. It's a challenge to come here and race at Phillip Island, considering that the majority of the 250 post-classic bikes are all two-strokes, many of them factory, twin-cylinder, Yamaha, Suzuki race bikes. So they're quite fast. The top runners are almost untouchable. However, on the four-stroke end of the spectrum, we're representing quite well. Eirik and I are finishing second, third, and fourth, and fifth against a majority field of two-strokes. So it's going fairly well. Bikes are in pretty good tune. I haven't had any mishaps yet. My bike is doing all right. It's a little down on power. It's a little tired. I actually raced it at the Isle of Man Classic TT in August, and it was a brand new engine build for that, and then it came directly here. So I've had to uncrate it and tune it for these conditions. And it was a brand new bike for me. I built it for the TT just to start. So it's a little tired. I did the math, and one season at the TT is equivalent to 6 seasons at home.
In terms of the number of kilometers you log on the track.
Exactly.
Wow.
If you calculate one class, 6 events. So it's I rode 28 laps total, which is, I don't know, 600 miles or 800 miles, something like that.
It's a long way.
Yeah.
They're long laps, aren't they?
they're 38 miles, so they're they're long laps. Anyway, it's going well. It's going well.
And your bike is what?
It started life as a CB160/175. They're essentially the same basic bike. You can use a 175 or 160 frame, doesn't matter. We're currently running 175 bottom ends because you can get a 5-speed in there. And then they're built out there to 200 cc's to race Arma. My Isle of Man bike is a 250 cc bike. So.
Yeah. And so you run 6-speed box?
No, there's no 6-speed available.
There's no 6-speed available.
No, they're just stock transmissions.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So what sort of speed are you getting down the straight here? I should imagine that you'd be getting a similar sort of speed down the straight here as you would be getting on some of the long straights at the Isle of Man.
You would think. However, I'm getting 175. No, wait a minute. Top speed kilometers, 155. So around 95 miles an hour, I think. The challenge here at the Phillip Island is the wind has been brutal every day. So I'm not really able to hit fifth gear and pull red line here. While the Isle of Man, there are 3 long, significant downhill straightaways coming into Craig Na Bha that allow you to over-rev the bike. So there I was running significantly shorter gearing and still over-revving the bike, and here I'm not quite able to do that. So I would assume with Isle of Man, I was probably hitting about 115 max, and here I'm 95, seems to be.
Tucked in, elbows tucked in, chin tucked in.
Hand off the handle, left handlebars sucked into the tank.
You're just flat track stuff.
Trying to get small, yeah.
Right, okay. So John, what's your history? Where did you get involved in this crazy game of motorcycle racing?
I started in 1995, and I was forbidden motorcycles by my mother, and so I always had the desire. I covertly rode them, my friend's motorcycles, and without really developing any skill. And then when I was after college and got my first job, I realized my mom wasn't around. I had some money, and I bought my first motorcycle, street bike. And within 6 months, I was on the racetrack racing. And kind of went from there. I started out with modern bikes, Honda 650 Twins, and so on. Went through the typical learning curve of crashing and blowing up a lot, and began to refine my approach, and also then got the vintage bug in 97 and went armor racing for the first time in the CB 350 sportsman class.
What was the attraction going from modern bikes to historic bikes? How did that happen?
There's a very different interaction with the motorcycle. It's it also is combined with my desire to build. I'm a builder. I'm a designer by trade, so I like making things. For me, the perfect formula is building it, tuning it, racing it, and winning on it. And that's part of my whole complete race program, is enjoying that full circle. It's very, very rewarding, and that's harder to do on a modern motorcycle because they're quite highly tuned from the factory. There's not a lot you can do. The scale is quite different. And so there's that piece. I just think that vintage motorcycles are cool looking, cool sounding. It's a more visceral interaction with the machine. You feel like you're going faster on a slower bike, which is cool. Sights, sounds, smells, plus the attitude of the people who race them is a little bit different. And I enjoy that quite well also.
Actually a lot different.
Yeah, I'd say very, very different. So. You have just cooler interactions, you know, when you go to, and I still have modern bikes, I still occasionally race them, I still do, I teach track days on modern bikes, so it's not as if I'm withdrawn from that, but you go to the racetrack, and I still race club racing locally, and, you know, it's about mostly modern bikes, and the attitude there is a bit more aggressive and shallow, and a lot of these guys come in, race for 2-3 years, learn it's expensive and it hurts, and they go away. So the culture is different, and here I've been doing this long enough, and I've known people in these pits for 18 years, and you travel the world, you begin to make friends, and it's just a very, very different vibe.
So there's a longevity to historic racing that you don't always get in modern bike racing.
No, I don't think so. And there, it's just you want the new. Next year, you buy the next bike. Everybody's saving up to buy the newest R6 or whatever, and that's their ambition. I want to improve my formula. I've been racing this bike here since 1997, and this 350, and highly developing it. I've been racing the CB160/175 since 2000, and they're highly developed. That's part of my whole thing.
So, John, when you say racing locally, where is locally?
Well, we live in Portland, Oregon, and so we have our local club, the Oregon Motorcycle Road Racing Association, OMRA. We also can race in Washington, which is nearby. They've got a couple of amazing tracks at Wormra. And then we do quite a lot of armor races, which is not local, of course.
And how far afield do you travel to race this bike?
How far afield? Quite far. All the way to the Isle of Man. I can't do the math in my head, but it's
that's
many fair way. Australia, and then an Arma. We'll travel to Daytona, Barber, Groton, Road America, NOLA, Miller, Sears Point, Willow Springs, all the tracks. Yeah.
So you traverse the length and breadth of America?
Yeah, yeah.
And travel overseas as well?
Yeah, quite a bit, sure, yeah.
Now, you know, obviously, at some stage of the series, I'm going to ask you your impressions of Philip Barber. You've already said the wind is a problem. Of course, it is with a small bike. Yeah. I guess the only upside of that is that it is at least the same for everybody.
That's true. Yeah.
But what do you think about Philip Barber?
It's amazing. I've heard his claim to fame is the fastest track in the world. I can believe that. The biggest combination of fast sweeping corners where you are tapped out in fourth or fifth gear, full throttle, with your knee on the deck, and long ones too. Some of them 180 degrees or beyond. Leaving turn 10, 11, onto the straightaway is beyond 180 degrees, and you're accelerating up, knee on the ground the whole time, using every inch of the track to maximize your acceleration out of the straight. That's phenomenal. And then you go into turns 1, 2, and 3, it's the same thing. There's very few tracks that have that amount of just fast, fast, fast sweepers where you're constantly on the go, combined with two serious braking, hard cornering turns. So that's what I like about it the most. And the traction is phenomenal. It's amazing. It's also, the view is stunning. It's hard not to look at the ocean as you come into turn one and go through turn two. You're looking at this beautiful coastline and waves breaking. And I do admit sometimes I'm like, that's beautiful, while I'm, you know, pitching it in. So there's that. And there are the world's most stubborn and resilient geese I've ever seen. There is geese all the time in turn 7 going up the hill that just stand right off the edge of the track and they don't move. Some of them stand on the curbing. And then last year, there was about 4 of them on the track, and they were out on the track for at least 4 laps. And I came through a group of bikes. I didn't see them because I was drafting. I popped through, and all these guys were stacking up to one side. I didn't understand why until I popped through and realized that I had to thread the needle between a pot of
geese.
Yeah, and they didn't, to their credit, they didn't move an inch, so it was good for me. If they tried to flee, I would have hit them, but yeah. So it's all those things, and the people are phenomenally friendly here, and they take a great deal of interest in us and motorcycle racing, and it's just a really cool experience all around.
Well, we love having you guys here. Some very significant respects. Australians and Americans are very similar people, very open, friendly, take people as they come, you know, no preconceptions or anything else like that, and we just like having a good time, and we just love having a good time when you guys come down, because we have a good time with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. Australians and Americans are similar in that sort of hospitality way, very friendly. We've just met amazing people, really friendly, had a great time, talked to a lot of people. We're staying at the beach, so we get to meet people every evening, go for a swim after the race, and it's been fantastic.
And the buzz of being here, of course, is that everybody helps everybody. Unlike modern racing, which is a bit, you know, everybody keeps themselves and keeps their own...
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah.
These guys just, you know, if you need it, they'll give it to you.
Absolutely, that's totally true. It's just that's a common thread amongst classic racing throughout the world.
Yep.
That people are ready, willing to help and hand over parts or tools or whatever is needed to get the job done. That's very clear. So I've thought of many examples this last few days where people have come by and asked and I've given, or people I've gone by and asked and people have given back. So it's fantastic.
John, great to have you back.
Thanks.
And, I'm glad you're having fun. There's a big smile on your face, so you must be having fun.
Oh, I'm having an absolute blast.
And we'd love to see you back again in 2016 with Team USA again. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, we're talking to, well, she probably won't like this, but we're talking to the First Lady of Australian Motorcycle Racing, Peggy Hyde. Peggy, welcome to Phillip Island. Welcome to Moto Podcast. And this must be like a blast from the past for you.
It certainly is. I've come back like Rip Van Winkle, having skipped over 40 years in between.
So what have you been doing in the last 40 years, Peggy?
I went sailing. I went out through the heads at Sydney, and it was a bit like a childhood book I'd had which said Over the Hills and Far Away. And it wasn't really intended to be like that, but that's how it happened.
And that's sometimes the best thing, isn't it? Just to sort of go and see where it takes you.
Yes, there are a few other things that happened along the way. I had some serious illness, which kept me out of going on with what I expected to be my teaching career. And so I decided to take a year off and recuperate. But it sort of led on to other things.
Peggy, take us through your racing career, because of course most of our listeners won't know you. Many of them won't have ever heard of you. What enticed you to go motorcycle racing at a time when it was strictly a man's sport?
Well, I bought a motorbike purely for transport, and I discovered that it was fun. You know, you get on a bike for the first time and, wow, this is great. Same as I did when I first felt the tiller of a yacht and the wind in the sails. Same sort of thing. And I just wanted to be able to play in the sand pit like the other kids. And why shouldn't I? I couldn't see why women shouldn't be allowed to. I was surprised when they tried to stop me.
And when was this, Peggy? Put a date on it for us.
Probably 1966. And I applied for a licence and it was granted. And but by the time I'd ridden in three meetings, suddenly somebody realised there was a woman on the track. And so somebody decided to restrict my licence. And they couldn't give me a good reason. And I think I went
because
to...
Because there isn't one.
Because there isn't one, exactly. And I had all good reports. So it just went on from there. And that was ahead of the world. Australia was ahead of the world in allowing women to race motorbikes on equal terms with men. And so that would have been settled by... Although I do have some records that show that there was another glitch about 1969. I must have had to fight the same battle all over again, I think. I just don't recall the details.
And Peggy, you rode in the early Castrol 6-hour production bike races at Amaru Park, didn't you?
Yes, in the first one. And came fourth in the 500 class by one lap. Lost 20 along the way with a muffler falling off. This was a very old bike by then, well and truly battered. It wasn't... It just got through the race, really. There was quite a lot falling apart with its innards by the time that race ended. It was great fun. And Rod Tingate was my co-rider that time. We shared the riding.
And he's here today.
He is here today, yes. It's wonderful to see him.
Yes, he's a wonderful man, there's no doubt about him. I actually asked him if I could do an interview with him and talk to him about all the things he's done, and he sort of looked at me and said, "Oh, no, probably not."
Yeah.
That's the sort of guy he is.
He is.
He's the classic backroom man that gets things done.
Well, he is, but I believe he had a win here last year.
Yes. No, he's a top bloke. So, Peggy, you
You sort of got a name for riding the big, hairy Kawasaki 500, the triple back then used to be called the Widowmaker.
Yes.
Had a hinge in the middle of the frame and, a power band that came in at 6,750 and went out at 6,790 and had to keep it in that power band to get it to do anything.
Yes.
Yeah, that must have been a really hairy thing to ride.
Well, yes, but I'd had a T20 prior to that, a Suzuki T20, which also had a very narrow power band, and you just kept it on song, so that was no big deal. The handling was peculiar, and a lot of fiddling to get it not to wobble on the straight, and cornering, its peculiarities. You had to use the throttle to put it down, you had to shut off to put it down. I remember there were a lot of little tricks to it for hard riding.
Yep. A lot of our listeners who are listening who won't have known about the Castrol 6-hour race, this was held on a track in Sydney that had a lap of 1.1 kilometres.
Very tight and windy, yes. It didn't. A lot of people say it doesn't actually have a straight.
No, that's right.
Yes. It's got a bit of a straight, but you're just coming out of one corner and really lining up for the next.
And back in that day, they had a 250 class, didn't they? So the unlimited bikes, the big bikes that you were riding, were the closing speeds between them and the small bikes was very considerable, wasn't it?
Yes, but the small bikes could get around the track a lot. There was a couple of, at least one really tight corner that I remember. And, you could get around it nearly as fast on a little Suzuki 250 as you could on a bigger bike.
Yes.
Of course, as you got into the bigger bikes, they had a bit more oomph getting out of the corner on the straight.
Now, Peggy, did you ride in 73?
No, I was not riding 73. Wait a minute. That's a long time ago.
I'm just asking because that was the year that Kenny Blake won on the Z1 Kawasaki and he rode the whole race solo.
Where was I in 73? Goodness. Yes, I must have. 69, 70, 71. I rode four of them and missed one, so you can add that up.
Right, okay.
74. Yes, I might have been there, yes. Yes.
Peggy, correct me if I'm wrong here, there's an apocryphal story going around that you were the person that ran into the back of the ambulance.
No way.
No, I'm just saying this is an apocryphal yes. story that's going around.
Yes.
And, you can put it to rest for us because there's a lot of people say that it happened.
Well, I think that it was something to do with Ross King. Who was also riding a Mach 3. But he was riding a different Mach 3 to the Mach 3 that he'd been riding in the previous events. And so he might have had something to prove. But there were a huge number of crashes in that first race. I think something like, somewhere I've got it written down, but I think it's something like about a third of the field, or 22 bikes or something like that, got through that race without crashing at least once. And I was on one of the ones and I did not crash or get into trouble, neither. My co-rider and myself, we didn't get into any trouble through that race.
Right.
And our motto was to preserve the bike,
yes.
finish the race.
Yes.
And of course, this had never been done before
no.
for us. And so we were cautious, but we did well.
Yes. Mm. Peggy, coming back to motorcycling after many, many years away, you must notice some astonishing differences. What are the differences and what are the similarities?
Well, I think the people are pretty much the same. The bikes all still have two wheels, but you've now got disc brakes, which are only just coming in when I got out. The frames, the whole handling thing has been addressed perhaps more intelligently. We were really riding pretty crude machines when you think about it.
Indeed. Oh, they were terribly crude, yes.
Yeah. Yes.
And terrible tyres too.
Oh, the tyres, yes. Yeah, they were terrible. And I think I was heading in the right direction when I looked at what tyres were available and went for the big Metzler tyres and low pressures. I suppose I was trying to get a lot of tyre on the track.
Yes.
And it certainly worked for me. I experimented with other things, like having a bigger disparity between the front and the back sizes, which one occasion it improved the handling of for Emery Park of I think it was a Honda 500 four-stroke for a long race, but the trouble was it scrubbed out the front tyres that quickly that we never would have made it. So those were your choices back then.
Yes. All compromises,
yes. And the
approximately 2 minutes to the start of Unlimited Classic.
Putting together all those bits and pieces, you'd sort of sort something out, and then that would show up a flaw somewhere else, and
yes.
So you'd fiddle and discover something. Yeah, that's
area.
Right. Yes, yeah. Yes.
Peggy, you've told me on previous occasions that you not only encountered a lot of sort of beneath the surface sort of irregularities, but you also experienced a lot of outright blatant sexism.
Oh yes.
On the track as well.
Yes, there was there were a few incidents. A lot of it happened beyond my immediate knowledge, of course. And you do wonder about the occasional odd thing that happens when you're the only rider in the track that gets a checkered flag when you're doing very well, like running second or third, as happened on one occasion. I get a checkered flag, so I come in. Nobody else got it. You know, they all got the other flag. And, you know, what can you say?
So, Peggy, you were a pioneer, and it's good to say that after you, lots of other girls came along and raced and did very well, like people like Jenny Coates, Debbie Brinkley, and girls like that, and others who are racing now today really owe their relatively easy passage into the sport because you were the pioneer. You sort of kicked the door open.
Yes, and I kept at it until that was all clear, that it was accepted that women were on the track. That was very important. But the sad thing was that the way it went was that I did have to prove it by being better than the blokes.
Yes.
And that's not right, of course.
No, of course it's not.
But that's how it was, and because then the guys have got nothing left to say.
Yes.
Those ones who were objecting. Look, there were lots of guys who were very supportive.
Yes.
And didn't treat me any differently, and used to get a giggle out of their mates who couldn't handle it and that sort of thing.
Peggy, I'm going to let you go. Yes. They're starting up the H2 over there. I really need to let you get going.
H1.
The H1, sorry. Thank you so much for your time. It's great to talk to you. And thank you for kicking the door in. We really appreciate that.
Okay,
Have
you.
A great weekend.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.
I'm sure you will.
Thank you. All right, well, we're going to try and persevere with the noise from next door, and hopefully those guys on those noisy English bikes will be gone fairly shortly. I'm in the pits here talking to Scout Fletcher from New Zealand. New Zealand's second fastest lady racer, I believe.
Yeah, well, we're hoping so. We've just got a battle to have with Avalon one day, and, you know, that'll be the decider.
Yeah, well, she's got a bit of a start on you, hasn't she?
Oh, yeah, she's actually pretty much my hero, you know. I really look up to her. Yep, she's done a lot of riding overseas and stuff, and hopefully I can catch up one of these days.
It's funny, I saw Avalon racing a little 80cc bike at Wakefield Park. It must have been 10 years ago as a junior. I think she was 13 or something.
Oh, wow.
Major proceedings. And, New Zealand guys were saying to me, you know, watch this kid, she's going to go places. And I thought, I tucked it away probably more than anything else, A, because she was a girl,
yeah,
B, because she had an unusual name. I thought, I'll remember her, and I've been following her on Facebook, she's doing sensationally well, and, you know, we could have worse heroes, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
So what's your story? Where did you start and why?
Well, I started racing in Canterbury, with Motorcycling Canterbury, at age about 13 or 14. Had a really cool trainer named Peter Jones, good friend of ours, who, with the Motorcycling Canterbury crew, got me involved in junior street stock, which is basically 152 stroke racing. So, yep, that's where it all started, and then carried on through to 125 Grand Prix bikes with Team Race Supplies, and did fairly well in that. And then also, separately to that, have been racing classics, everything from the really early Rudgers and Aerials. I have to thank Peter Jones and Linda Maddock for that. Right through to the old, you know, the TZs, the Manx Nortons, yeah.
Because we like to pride ourselves here, the historic racing is strong here in Australia, but it's massive in New Zealand, isn't it?
It's pretty, you know, pretty big organisation in New Zealand too. I mean, we don't have nearly as many posties in New Zealand. It's sort of, you know, hardly any TZs or anything. But I find that we have quite a few, aerials and really older bikes, BSAs from like the early, you know, the 50s backwards. And, we're really lucky to have some beautiful machines such as the ones owned by Linda and Normatic, you know, the really special Isle of Man Rudge that Graham Walker raced at the Isle of Man, and you know, just some real one-of-a-kind bikes there.
I'm trying to get my head around a 21st century teenage girl racing a bike that was built in the 1920s.
It's definitely something different. You know, not a lot of younger people are into the classics, which is a real, real shame. And I mean, I'd probably say I'm one of the only young classic, you know, racers in New Zealand, which is a shame.
It's interesting that you should say that, because on a number of other interviews that I've been doing this weekend, I've been touching on trying to get some people to crystal ball the classic bike movement in 10 years' time, when Robbie Phillips and Malcolm Campbell and all of your New Zealand hero guys have finally decided to hang up the helmet. And I'm trying to sort of crystal ball, where is it going to go? Who are the people who are going to carry on the tradition, or is it just going to fall in a hole?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm getting very confident that the young people like you, who are interested in these old rattling things, you know, if you're being interested in that, then, you know, the sport is going to be left in good hands.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's hoping. You know, I mean, you've had, like, the clubs, you know, such as the Barry Sheen, the people who run that, who have been really, really encouraging younger people to get into it. You know, for example, they recently had the one in New Zealand where they had the women races, and they had all of us on classics, which, you know, introduced the likes of Avalon and young people like Mihi Banks and stuff into the classic scene, which they never would have tried otherwise, and they absolutely had a ball on it.
And Maria Costello.
And Maria, of course, who was there as a guest. That was really, really cool. And, it's also, I think, about carrying on the knowledge, because a lot of the time, you know, people don't want to race classics, not just because they're really quite hard to ride, you know, they're just all over the place, but because, you know, they're so hard to maintain, and there's not a lot of knowledge about, you know, sort of like the DIY knowledge that they used to have of fixing things, changing
it's
things.
Fascinating perception.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating, and I can't believe that I hadn't thought of that. But yes, of course, the knowledge base of how to fettle these things is passing along with the riders, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's something which, you know, that a lot of people aren't learning now, which is a real shame, because you have the likes of, for example, a very good friend of mine, Linda Maddock and Norm Maddock, who live in Warkworth, and they're one of the only, I think, fully reconditioned Magneto people in sort of the Southern Hemisphere, maybe one or two others. And, you know, when they're gone, who's going to do it? Yeah, you know, yeah. What's left?
That's a stunning perception, because not only are the riders moving on, but the skill base is going away as well.
Yeah.
Because with modern bikes, you know, that skill base is no longer quite so necessary. It's sort of take out that dud component and
put it in a new one.
component.
Exactly.
And the thing will work again.
Yeah, and just the likes of, I think, tuning and or just keeping it low cost, basically, you know, low cost tuning and maintaining and.
I'm shaking my head here. It's such an out of left field thought, but you're absolutely right, you know. So not only do we have to maintain the riders, we've got to maintain the people that have the skills to keep the bikes going as
yeah.
well. And you look around the pits around here, most of these guys are old and grey.
Yeah.
And particularly yeah. the guys doing the tuning.
Yeah, exactly. They all have that sort of knowledge that, you know, comes from experience, many, many, many years of doing it wrong, doing it right, but, you know, a lot of people aren't going to persist with that now because of the money and the time.
You're not just a pretty face, are you? Seriously, that is amazing. I'm stoked. So where to from here?
I sort of got two paths going on right now. I'm racing modern bikes and kind of trying to pursue that at the moment, you know. I went and like had the rookie season 125, which went really, really well, and managed to do well in the New Zealand champs. I went over to Europe early last year to do some wildcard races, and I mean that didn't go to plan, but I put that down to an amateur setup. But you know, I know now what's required, and at the moment we're just pursuing the a sort of a podium finish in the New Zealand Championships for the SV650 Pro Twins. So I've sort of got that going on. I'm trying to progress my modern racing career as much as I can while I'm young and fit and able.
Yep.
And on the other hand, I have my sort of my real passion, which is, you know, classic racing. And I'm just trying to take that as far as I can and get as much experience on as many different bikes, you know, from the early, really early era bikes, hand changes, right through to the Manxes, through to like the, you know, more modern TZs and RDs and so on. So just trying to keep that alive and learn as much as I can so that I can, you know, pass it on, but also so I can kind of hopefully one day own my own bike or run some riders myself, but.
Well, the thing is, if you broaden your skill base in terms of the number of bikes you can ride, you broaden your riding opportunities, don't you?
Yeah, for sure. And you sort of build up a reputation for being able to handle and, you know, yeah, just be well equipped with all the skills required to ride anything sort of different. And that's something I'm really, really proud of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you should be. I know the rule is you can never ask a lady her age, but for the benefit of our listeners who can't see you, how old are you?
19.
My grandmother used to say that you can't put an old head on young shoulders. She said, usually. So there are exceptions. It's great to talk to you. Saw your racing machine, and I've watched you racing here, and your name is one of the names on the list. I thought, I've got to sit down with this kid and find out what makes her tick. And what makes her tick is that you're just passionate about all sorts of motorcycle racing.
Yeah, anything on two wheels.
Do you have a family history of motorcycling?
No, not particularly. I mean, my dad is extremely, extremely passionate about bikes and has always ridden classic bikes. Never been into racing until now. You know, we both got into it together and he now races a classic Ariel. But, yeah, he's sort of just really been passionate. And Mum just supported me in whatever I wanted to do. And my sister and the rest of my family did too. Of course, they, you know, close their eyes, hand over faces when I go around the track. But, I really, really have to thank my dad because he's just been there the whole way, supported me through ups and downs, many downs. And he's sort of, you know, the one that's kept it going.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So sponsored by Mum and Dad.
Yeah, sponsored by Dad mainly now and a lot of other personal sponsors, you know, like Makaleli Brick Block and Stone and Walsh Construction. Window Woman, who's Mary, she's a very good friend. She's here supporting me because Dad couldn't come over. And, you know, Linda and Ormatic, Peter Jones, just all those crew, you know, are really fantastic sponsors and great friends. And just, yeah.
See, what you're doing here is what we should be doing with our young riders. Pretty much we are, because in this day and age it's not enough for you to simply be a good rider. You know, you have to be a good rider, but you also have to have the other aspects. You have to be able to speak to the media, you have
yeah.
to look after your sponsors,
yeah.
You have to do all these other things as well, because team owners and people who are hiring riders are looking for people with all of those skills, not just the fact that they can break the lap record.
Yeah.
And because you've come up through those junior ranks where they teach you that sort of stuff, to you, you're sort of looking at me as if, well, doesn't everybody do that? Well, no, the answer is no, they don't.
Ah.
They don't. You know, but to you, that's just second nature now too, because that's the way that you've learnt, and that's what's got you where you are.
Yeah.
It's great to talk to you, Scout.
Yeah, thank you.
And I've got to ask a personal question. Why Scout? Why did your mum and dad choose to call you that?
Well, I get asked this quite a lot, and I'm sort of still pondering over the answer, but mum told me, she was assured me that it was from To Kill a Mockingbird, you know. She really liked the name, but, you know, dad assures me that it's because of an Indian scout. So I think I'm going to go with Dad's option. I think I like that better.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate. Yeah. Because let's face it, To Kill a Mockingbird is going to be lost on most people now, because hardly anybody has read that book anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Scout, it's great to talk to you. Thank
you
so
thank
much.
Thank
you
very
time.
Much.
And thanks for the old head on young shoulders. I really appreciate it. From a personal point of view, that's given me something to think about that I'd never even thought about before, so I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for your time, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
All right, we're back at the Team USA pit now. We're roving far and wide in the pits at the Island Classic here in 2015, and great to welcome back to Australia Wade Boyd and Christine Blunt from Team USA and Subculture Racing. And first of all, welcome back, guys. It's great to have you back, and it's just great to see you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, really nice to be back. We wait all year and really look forward to it.
Yeah, talking about it and how much fun we had. And
what are we gonna do? We got to get a new bike. We got to get in the challenge, and we need something big and fast.
It's been a busy year. Wade, you had a serious road accident on your bike during the year, and that laid you up for a while, and that sort of put paid to some plans, didn't it?
Yeah, we were going to Pikes Peak the very next day. I totally got taken out. My bike got destroyed. I spent 7 weeks laying on my back with a cast. We were leaving the next day, and we had just got my plane ticket to go to the Manx, which was in like 7 weeks. So I told the doctor, I said, I'm going to be a good patient, which is very rare, because I wanted to be ready and take the cast off on time, and I'm going racing, or back to work, as I call it.
Don't tell me you actually did what the doctors told you for once.
Oh, I did. I never fell down. I never stepped on it. I never tweaked it. I was such a good patient. Thanks to Christine, she totally took care of me. Unbelievable what I couldn't do anything, and she totally saved me.
Been there and done that a little bit, and it's the loss of independence that's the really frustrating part, isn't it? Having to ask someone to do something for you that you've been able to do for yourself all your life.
Yeah, anything, everything. Even when it actually happened, I never got up. I was awake and everything, but I never got up. I never saw my bike. And then I politely got tortured by a couple doctors and one of the medics and stuff. And I had 3 or 4 accidents all in that one. I hit the car twice, I hit the ground once. I got a little abused by one of the ambulance guys, almost ripped my foot off because he couldn't figure out how to take my boot off. And then I'm in the hospital, and all the doctors keep coming over and picking my foot up by my big toe, and I got 4 broken toes.
But actually, the funniest thing was, so when he was
funny?
No,
you're smiling.
The most funniest thing was actually when he was going to the TT, and I was asking him, I say, wait, you think you fit your foot in your boot? And he said, yeah, I can fit it. And I said, well, can you show it to me? That was the day before he was leaving. And then, you know the Cinderella story, when one of the stepgirls' daughters was trying to put their foot in the glass shoe?
Yes.
That's how he looked. It will fit, it will fit, it will fit. And he just squeezed his foot in there and say, oh, it's fine, it's so fine, I can race.
Tears running down his cheeks as he did it.
Yes, exactly. And I was like, wait, this is insane. But I will let you go.
That reminds me a little bit of the one in On Any Sunday, remember, where the guy turned up with his foot in a cast, and so he sawed the cast off and went racing anyway.
Yeah.
Wade, of course, the major disappointment for you guys is that there's no sidecar races here at the Island Classic. There's a lot more to that story, I'm sure. I don't know what it is, but there's a lot more to that story. And, you guys must have absolutely been shattered when you found out that the bike was all prepped and ready to go and there was no race to go to.
Yeah, that's our main ride. We actually won the race and everything. We made a lot of friends here. We're really looking forward to racing with Doug and everybody, and it was some of our best races we've ever had. And we went and bought an A bike, and so I got a bike that's kind of slow and everything. But I'm riding. But yeah, the sidecar is here. It's on display. We hope everybody talks it up, and even the officials said they're going to try and bring them back next year, and we sure hope so. It's really dangerous. Once you're out, a lot of times you're not back in. And a lot of the community want to see the sidecars, and we have a great time on it, you know.
Yeah, I understand that. Christine, that puts you out of the game, doesn't it?
Yes, he is lucky. He has a bike at least, but I just sit around and look pretty.
Which you do remarkably well, I have to say.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
And you also go shopping as well?
Yes, of course. Pressure. I have to do something now, I mean.
Yeah. A little bored. So now she's shopping for a Honda 160.
Yes, I think
she'll have a bike for next year.
Exactly. So if this happens again, I have a backup plan, and we'll have a 160, so I can do something too.
Now, Wade, of course, your Kawasaki Z1000 was slung together at the last minute when you realised that you weren't going to be able to ride the sidecar, and it's been a bit of a drama, hasn't it?
Yeah, we've been throwing wrenches the whole time. I figured it'd work me a little bit, but it's kind of been working me a lot. So I got a new mechanic today, came over to help, totally saved me, told me a lot of things I didn't know, and we got it together at the last second, and I actually started and finished the race on cue, and actually beat one guy.
Well, that's good, yeah, because this far from home, you don't have the parts, and you don't have the time.
Yeah, and then there's not too many Kawasaki's around, and then to find the parts, when you need it, I need it right now, I need it yesterday, and what do you need? And you don't know till it breaks. This morning I got here, I thought it was fine, I pulled it off the sand, checked it out, and I could only get first gear in neutral, and I thought I was blown. I'm out of the race. What's wrong with it now? This guy came over and totally saved us. Oh, it's supposed to do that. I never tried to start in second gear before, so I didn't know that it wouldn't do that. There's a little ball bearing in there. Anyhow, there's this thing that it's not supposed to do that.
Famous mechanic. Everybody knows him, and when he says this is unfixable, it's unfixable. He can fix anything. Unfortunately, now we don't know his name.
It's on the tip of my tongue, but I forgot it. Yeah, he totally set us up. He knew everything about it. It'll do this, it'll do that. And my springs were wrong. Somebody put the wrong springs in it, so they were coil binding on the inside. And
not too many clutch plates.
Yeah, he wanted a steel one instead of a cork one. The cork one made it a little too fat, so it was like gorilla tight. He goes, oh, that's totally wrong. Well, here's what we'll do to fix it. And yeah, totally saved the day. And with like 5 minutes to go, we buttoned it up and went out and got that race.
That's great. Well, yeah, it's a terrific story. And for me, it's a really terrific story because, where normally I just wander around and make a nuisance of myself, this time I've actually had an active part to play in the racing, and I got a huge buzz out of that.
You're
totally
part of the team now. Your bike is, parts of your bike are out there running around.
I tell you what, you have no idea what a thrill that is to me. You just cannot understand how thrilled I am about that.
That's great.
Yeah. So, if the sidecar guys get together, you'll bring the same rig back, or you'll build a new one?
No, we'll bring the same one back. They told me, we talked to them last year, they said, oh, your rig's not so good and blah, blah, blah. I was like, yeah, well, if I had a real one, it would be illegal. And it's like, and they also asked, well, did you pump it all up? No, I gave it a tune-up. I wouldn't do that to you guys. You know, it runs good. It's won every race it's been in for the last year or two, so I'm not going to change something that works that good.
Don't reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, so I put tires on and I gave it a tune-up, and it's ready to go.
It was actually ready for Pikes Peak, so we didn't have to do this much, but we didn't race Pikes Peak because of
the accident.
Of the accident, so it was actually ready to go.
Yeah. It fascinates me that because America is such a big place, like Australia, you can have people from opposite sides of the country who are racing for the same team and don't even know each other. And I always find that really interesting because you guys are West Coast, you know, California, yep. You know, and we got guys here from New Hampshire and Rhode Island and
yeah, we don't know any of those guys. We meet them all here. Yeah. Oh, you're our new buddy.
Yeah,
oh, you're an American. All right. You know.
And but in the end, it's Team USA, isn't it?
Yeah. We even rent a couple of your guys, and now they're Team USA too to fill in because we're missing a couple.
Yes.
You know, and that's fine. Everybody has fun, and they don't mind being on our team.
And we're just sitting outside the pits here with Otis Lance's leathers hanging on the wall behind us here, reminding us that that Otis should be here, but he's not because of his terrible road accident as well.
Yeah.
And everybody's missing him. And there's a big Go Team Otis sign hanging above us here. And we're hopeful that he'll be back next year because he's made himself part of the team as well.
We're all pulling for him.
Yeah.
He really wanted to be here. He's here in spirit. Hopefully everybody's sending pictures home, and you know, so we want to put a smile on his face. We want to see him back.
Absolutely. And I hear that he's working behind the scenes to attract the attention of a few names, shall we say, that everybody in the sport will know to come back and be part of Team USA next year.
Cool, that would be really good.
Yeah. We can't say any names, but Otter's got some pull.
There you go, yeah, nice. Yeah, we hadn't heard that, but yeah, everybody else has kind of been working on it, but those guys are all too busy or something. I don't know, they haven't heard that this is a big event.
Well, I think the most important thing is they haven't heard how much fun it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not going to get paid, but hell, they're going to have fun.
Yeah, the track is absolutely gorgeous. It's one of the best tracks that we've ever been on, even in the world, so... It's smooth, it's fast, and it's very safe, if you can actually say that.
Yes.
Most tracks, you can't say that.
So, and that leads me into the Isle of Man. You're going back to the TT this year?
Actually, I'm going to the Manx. We're trying to get it together to get back to the TT, but definitely into the Manx. I usually get four entries. We're building four bikes. I got somebody who's actually sponsoring me now. He's building three bikes right now as we speak. He should have been here, but he goes, stop talking about it, because he had to go in for surgery like this weekend. But he'll be here next year with some good toys. But yeah, we're building three or four bikes to go to the Manx. Hopefully we get in, do everything. We did really good in the Formula One, not this year, but last year. And we hope to do the same, and actually in every class. My 400 should do me really good. I should get a replica on it. We should be able to get a replica in Formula One. We're actually building a Moto Guzzi, which is really odd. So I'm watching the Guzzis out here. We're getting a lot of help from all the Guzzi fans in the world and stuff, and because there's a twins class. I barely knew about that. So anyhow.
More racing.
We'll give it a good go. I'll ride almost anything.
Yes. And you're going to bring a solo back here to the island next year?
Oh, yeah.
As well as the sidecar?
We have to bring a solo. For I need to be in the challenge to be with the group, to help promote it, so they will continue to invite us back.
Excellent. Well, I don't think there's any doubt that they'll continue to invite us back. This thing is getting to be bigger than Ben-Hur. And, Ben-Hur was pretty big anyway, so, yeah.
Yeah. So, anyhow, we want to be part of it on the sidecar and in the challenge.
And you're looking for a little Honda
160,
so you can run in the small classes.
When they have space, I would love to. I want to try it.
It's only a little bike; it'll fit in the container. Just shove everything up a little bit tighter and stick it in there.
You should see how packed our container is. It's like literally you can just close the door.
One more bike, and it would have had to go on top of our sidecar. But we beefed up the crate, so it could have happened, and it would have, should have happened.
So if anything goes down, it has to be on the sidecar.
So it's a giant game of three-dimensional Tetris.
Yes.
Trying to slop them all into spaces.
Yeah. We had 6 inches left in the container, period.
Yep.
Last year we had 2 inches left. Is it going to fit?
Yeah, but last year you had two containers.
On top
but,
of it.
But our container had 20 bikes and two containers full of parts and stuff. Anyhow, we put the sidecar in, and we had 2 inches left, period. And you look when they're empty and they go forever.
You think, God, you could fit a house in there, but you can't.
No.
I'm waiting for my 400 to come out of there. It's in there somewhere, isn't it? You know, more bikes, and yeah, it's finally in there. They're actually really big, but yeah, we fill them up.
Yeah. Well, of course, the thing is, you've got to bring so much stuff with you as well as the bikes, because you don't have your engineering department, you don't have all your tools, you don't have your workshop and your workbench and so forth. Everything that you need, you have to bring.
Yeah, totally. Some people are a little better set up, luckily, than others, and everybody shares. We keep going over to the, John Munn's place with the Honda 160s. He's got almost every tool. So everybody's got something, and we all share. You know, what do you got? What do you need? Here, take one of these. And it really helps. And even if you walk outside, other people will help you, whatever kind of whatever you need. Doesn't matter where you come from. You're here racing. Everybody just says, here,
it's
let me help out.
It's the camaraderie of racing, isn't it?
Yes.
It really makes it. I can't say I find that anywhere else on the planet. But we go racing, yeah. Everybody's realized we get help, especially the international races. It gets bigger. Everybody knows you tried so hard to get there, no matter where you came from. And the mission is all the same. Get out on the track. I can't race with you if you're not out there. How am I going to beat you if you're not out there?
Exactly.
You know? And if you beat me, well, it's your lucky day. If I've been, it's my lucky day. That's how we look at it, you know?
All right, I'll let you guys go. Thank you so much for chatting with us again. I know our listeners always love listening to what you guys have to say, because you bring a very interesting slant to what's happening here. I really dig the way that you guys go about doing stuff. It's very, very cool indeed. So have a great time.
Thank you.
Hope you find your bike.
Yes.
And we'll keep pressing on and fly the flag for Team USA.
All right.
There you go.
Right on.
Cheers.
Well, we hope you enjoyed those interviews from Phil Hall down at the PI Classic. Incredible insight to the people that bring that race series to us, and that we still have more to come from Phil down at PI before he heads down there for World Superbikes.
Yep, steady stream of Phil Hall interviews. As with Phil, he gets a lot of interviews, so we're trying to space them out, you know, keep the shows controllable and get the most we can.
Exactly right. So thank you guys for listening. Len, thank you for joining us. Harry, same to you. Look forward to speaking to you again and joining you down in London next week. That'll do.
We'll catch everyone next week.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.